loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and in studio with co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big issues. Saudi Arabia continues to push its regional offensive against Iran. The Saudis have denounced Iran at an extraordinary Arab League summit held in Cairo yesterday. And the region awaits the imminent return of Saad Hariri to Lebanon, where he is expected to explain the mysterious events surrounding his resignation. Then, new accusations have hit Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. over communications pertaining to Russia. Are more indictments on the way? Plus, Sputnik has once again been the target of fake news, with the Daily Beast and several other outlets falsely claiming that we have registered as a foreign agent. But first, we turn to the Middle East. We are joined from London by Robert Carter, a journalist and political commentator on Middle Eastern affairs. Welcome back, Robert.
Thank you very much for having me. Good to be back.
Thank you, Robert. And we're also joined from Beirut by Jana Nakhal. She is an independent researcher and a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. Welcome back, Jana.
Hi, thank you.
Jana, give us the perspective from where you are, from Lebanon. Every day brings new news. Talk about what's going on with your prime minister and also what the Saudi offensive actually is all about.
Every day brings on news, better news, that which make things much clearer. The whole order of things are now clear, where today Nasrallah, from the who's the Secretary General of Hezbollah, has announced that ISIS as a state has been defeated in the region. So things are much clearer now, and we can only see this as the reason why everything has been happening from KSA in the Arab League, the positions, the change of positions of the Lebanese prime minister, and also the kidnapping of the, let's put it this way, the kidnapping of the Lebanese prime minister.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, the Saudis have to fear that this defeat of ISIS emboldens the Iranians, their traditional enemies. Of course, the Saudis always have their little brothers, the Bahrainis, along with them. And I think that the Saudis are so preoccupied with Iran and so fearful of Iran that they're beginning to panic. And that's why we saw this extraordinary session of the Arab League. Now, Jana, tell me if I'm wrong. There have been many extraordinary sessions of the Arab League over the years, and they almost always amount to nothing. Do you expect anything to come out of this in the near future?
Never. We never expected anything before. We never expected anything when we were under attack from the Israelis, when Lebanon and the whole country was getting destroyed and people were getting killed. They had no time for us anyways to make a quick conference. As much as I remember, in 2006, they kept postponing their meeting because we were not important enough. And then now we were really not expecting anything. But it's funny, it's like we're watching how they're managing to change the discourse, or like make the discourse look more diplomatic once more. And it's funny to see that the same group that is killing Yemenis right now, that is causing the biggest famine in the world right now, is calling Hezbollah or the Lebanese state the Lebanese government terrorists.
Yeah, it's amazing. Robert Carter, what's your take? Go ahead, jump in.
Well, it's obviously hard to know exactly what's going to happen in the near future. I'm very fearful. I think that, I mean, if you look, the chief of the Arab League actually went to Beirut today to speak to President Aoun, and this comes after all of the heavy anti-Lebanon comments were made by the Arab League. The Arab League is a body which is, of course, corrupt, it's useless, but it's largely directed by Saudi Arabia and by the Gulf. And they've made very clear right now that they want to escalate tensions against Lebanon because they see Lebanon as being Iranian-backed or, you know, Hezbollah-run. But they're totally undermining and forgetting Lebanon's history at the same time. And as the other guests rightly mentioned, You know, Lebanon has a long history where they've fought on the front lines against imperialist policies on the region. They fought civil wars against Israel as well. So Saudi Arabia's behavior right now, particularly targeting a group which is so well recognized and has such a big history in Lebanon, like the Hezbollah does, to target them in such a way as if they're from Mars. This is the way that Saudi Arabia and the Gulf wants to portray the Hezbollah, as if they're from Mars. They're a foreign alien in that country. But of course, the Lebanese don't see it like that. And Lebanese history is, you know, doesn't recognize Saudi or the Gulf's perspective on Lebanon and its situation today. So they're being totally unreasonable. And it's that ability to realize and accept Lebanon for what it is that's going to lead to tensions at the end of the day, because Lebanon, you know, it can't change what it is. And Hezbollah, whether you like them or not, is an important player in that country. You know, they're in the Lebanese parliament, for example. And I think this is why the crisis has happened, because Hariri, who has traditionally been Saudi's man in the country, he actually was willing to negotiate with the Hezbollah. And there's even been suggestions made that he may have been willing to mediate between Saudi Arabia and Iran, regionally speaking, as well. At the end of the day, again, Hariri is a kind of loved and hated character in Lebanon, depending on who you ask. But it was his decision to back President Aoun, who was Hezbollah's candidate over a year ago, that led to the unity government. But Saudi Arabia, not Iran, are the ones who have now broken that unity government by forcing the prime minister to resign in Saudi Arabia.
Quite amazing, John Kiriakou. I mean, he announces his resignation, not in his country,
right,
not in Lebanon, but in Saudi Arabia. And then he shows up, not in his country, but in Paris.
Right.
His kids, though, are still, they're going to school
still
in Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. He also carries a Saudi passport. He's, even though he's the prime minister of Lebanon, he's a Saudi national, in addition to being a Lebanese national. You know, Brian, I think this was something of a coup. It's as though the Saudis attempted, at least, to force a coup on the people of Lebanon, whether they wanted it or not, with the idea being that the Lebanese government would then fall and the Saudis could blame it on Iranian meddling and Hezbollah. And that is not what has happened. Instead, now we know that that Hariri will return to Lebanon by Wednesday, and he's scheduled to explain himself to the Lebanese people. I'm actually very anxious to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, I think we all are. Jana, what do you think he'll say?
Well, looking at the changes in his discourse, I mean, we're not expecting him to say that the Saudis had kidnapped him as direct as this. But if you heard his second speech, so we had his resignation, and then after that, we had an interview with him. And his speech in this interview was very different. In the resignation, he wanted to, and I'm quoting, to cut the hands of the Iranians in Lebanon. While in his interview, which happened last week, he was, other than the fact that he was extremely tired and he looked as if he's very stressed, he was talking about a conversation, the need for conversation with the other, the need to open a discussion with the other factions in Lebanon, etc. So it was a totally different thing. Now, and all the time he's trying to tweet and say, I'm going back to my country, I'm safe, etc. Him going back to Paris has also, before Lebanon, has also proven that he was arrested. And then now coming back to Lebanon, I think that two things will change. First of all, a certain alliance is going to be strengthened with France. And a weaker relationship will be much clearer with KSA. But this cannot be seen outside what's been going on in the Gulf media for the past 2 or 3 weeks. It's been incredibly crazy. The kind and the content of the discourse that has been going on in the Gulf media, where the push for a war against Hezbollah and Iran has been portrayed as a push for war against those who kill people, and a push for a war to bring back the Beirut that we all love. It's as if Hezbollah was ISIS, really. They're trying to say that the backwardness and the killing that's been going on in the region is because of Hezbollah and not ISIS.
Robert Carter, if the Saudis go through all these machinations, they call a special session of the Arab League, they force Saad al-Hariri to resign, they make accusations against the Iranians and against Hezbollah, they essentially try to crash the Lebanese government, and then nothing happens. In my view, this seriously weakens Saudi Arabia in the region, does it not?
Well, I mean, I think that they have, I mean, you say that nothing's happened. You're right in a way, on the ground in Lebanon, nothing has changed. But, I mean, Saudi's move in Lebanon, I think, is the beginning of a new policy, which we're going to see develop over the next few years. So I don't think that Saudi Arabia has made any immediate big impact to Lebanon. I think right now, they're targeting Lebanon. And this was the first move. And it was a big move. I mean, obviously, it may not have had the success that they were hoping it would, but you know, they temporarily brought Lebanon's government to a stand. They've stopped and ripped up that unity government almost, and that's a big symbolic gesture. And that's what this is. This is largely a symbolic move. And I think that keeping Hariri away from Lebanon for such a long period of time, and again, I think that that's Saudi Arabia's work in telling Hariri not to return, is again very symbolic. It's a message to Lebanon that Saudi Arabia is not going to play ball. They're not going to allow Lebanon to continue peacefully, and they're going to undermine what they see as Iran's efforts in that country. And it does also mean that they're going to undermine Lebanon's independent government, because the Saudis view Aoun's administration as being pro-Iran, if you like. So they've made it very clear that they're going to undermine that going forward. Lebanon is a lot stronger than people think, and I think that they've handled the crisis so far very, very well, and I think that they will push on with the elections. But this was one of what I think will be a series of major pushes by the Gulf to undermine Lebanese sovereignty, and I fear that things are going to get a lot worse. This is just the beginning of a new regional policy, and I also will be interested to see how Saudi Arabia's policy towards Iraq will also develop. I think that they're related here, and I think that Saudi Arabia's moves to, you know, to connect with Muqtada al-Sadr's groups in Iraq, but then also undermine Lebanese politics in Lebanon, is part of a new broader regional strategy. We'll have to wait and see how that turns out.
Brian, there was an episode of 60 Minutes last night, the prominent, important news program here in the United States. It was about Saudi involvement in Yemen. And one of the things that really struck me about this program was that they never mentioned the United States in any way having to do with Yemen. And they couched the Saudi war against Yemen as very clear-cut good versus evil. They said something also that was very interesting, that Saudi Arabia is the leader of the world's Sunni Muslims. And they stated that as fact. And I remember thinking, I wonder what the Egyptians would have to say about something like that. Or the Jordanians or the Lebanese or any other Sunni country in the world. And it made me think about today's episode or today's program, our show here, and the discussion that we're having right now. Where are the Egyptians in all this? What are the Jordanians saying about all this? Because certainly they have to be concerned. They have to be concerned about a Saudi Arabia that is suddenly very, very activist and may not have the muscle behind it in order to really affect the change that it wants to make. And you can't bully your neighbors into doing what you want them to do. You know, we've seen that fail time and time again. Jana, can you tell us where are Saudi Arabia's neighbors in this crisis? Where are the Egyptians and the Jordanians?
So first of all, it's extremely patronizing and offensive to call Saudi Arabia as the leader of Muslims or Sunnis or whatever, because not only they're not a representative, and that most of the Sunni in the Arab world, and specifically in my region, talking about the Levant, so Lebanon, Palestine, and Syria, do not see this.
No.
Also, very much a huge problem from a discourse perspective, because it's inherently subdividing the peoples of this region into sects, which is not the case. We're subdivided into who's with Palestine and who's against Israel and who's not. That's how we see one another. That's how we see if you're anti-imperialist or not. That's how you are my enemy or my ally, instead of looking at the other as a Christian, Muslim, whatever. And so this is one. Two, for us, as I think I would speak as an Arab person, it's been a long time that we've had this huge, let's say, a schism between the peoples of the region and their leaderships and their, no matter what you call them, the royalty in Jordan or the dictator that you have in Egypt. So saying that they're not representative of their people, but this is also saying that they are paid by the Saudis most of the time.
Which has happened for years, I might add.
Exactly.
Robert Carter, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and when we're talking about KSA, that's who we mean, just for our lay audience here in Washington, D.C., they've had a series of stinging defeats, or certainly not victories. I mean, the defeat of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the terrorist groups in Syria that were struggling to overthrow the Assad government, that was a big defeat, a big setback for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen has succeeded in creating a lot of human misery, but it hasn't succeeded militarily. The United States is there. Donald Trump has announced another $110 billion commitment for new arms sales to KSA, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And of course, that was the exact number that Obama sold or helped sell to the Saudi Arabia during his 8-year tenure. But there again, they're not winning the war in Yemen. So stinging defeats. Also, Saudi Arabia is going through a big transition, a big leadership transition. The crown prince is really assuming effectively the position of head of state, and he will be soon the official head of state by all, you know, apparent, you know, sort of prognostications on that. So where does it leave the Saudis? Are they really on the offensive, or are they playing sort of a defensive game and trying to sort of do damage control with these kind of maneuvers?
Well, I think that the list of failures which you mentioned, you know, Saudi's policy on Yemen, Saudi's policy on Qatar, as far as another example, I think that these are all reasons which may be leading to the shift that we're seeing in Saudi Arabia right now. I mean, if you look at the individuals who were targeted in the recent power purge in Saudi Arabia, a lot of them would be considered potential kind of challengers or even rivals to Mohammed bin Salman.
We may have lost him.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Let me finish that thought.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because he was making an important point. That's why we've said on this program in the past couple of weeks that what we're seeing in Saudi Arabia is a coup. It's a soft coup, but what we are seeing is the current crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, rounding up cousins, princes, ministers, anybody who might conceivably pose a threat to him and to his primacy as crown prince. Now, there have been rumors floating around Washington for the previous several weeks saying that Mohammed bin Salman will become king because his father, King Salman, intends to abdicate. I heard a month ago that abdication would come soon after a visit to Washington, which is tentatively scheduled for January. Over the weekend, however, the press is reporting that the king may abdicate as soon as next week, in which case Mohammed bin Salman would be by far the youngest king in Saudi Arabia's history. He would also be a king with conflicts on several fronts. The war in Yemen, the conflict with Qatar, this undeclared proxy war against Iran, the crisis in Lebanon now. Things are not going well for the Saudis politically. And there's really no end in sight to this in the near term.
Go ahead, Jenna.
Yeah, I was saying it's not going well for the Saudis, neither politically nor economically. And this, I think, very few people are talking about, because the more bin Salman's policies and changes are economic changes are going to make people poorer in Saudi. But there's also one very important thing that we need to see. He's not only changing removing the competition around him. He's actually changing the essence of the how the state works in Saudi, meaning changing it from a horizontal form into a more vertical one. Because in Saudi Arabia, it's only the cousins who get into power, while now it's going to become the sons. And this is an incredibly big change in the governance.
That's a very important point, and it's absolutely true. Let me say something else. I spoke recently with a Saudi expert, formerly of the CIA, who's now with a major oil company. And he told me something that was very interesting. He said the Saudis are not able to make money unless oil is $60 a barrel. And it's been less than $60 a barrel for something like 2.5 years now, 3 years, something like that. As a result, they are unable to finance this war on Yemen over the long term. They can borrow to finance it now, but it's an unsustainable policy. At the same time, Mohammed bin Salman is going to have to buy the loyalty of a lot of people, including major tribes around the country. He doesn't have the money really to do that over the long term as well. So this is not going to be an easy accession to power. This is going to be troubled. Jana makes a very important point too, that the leadership structure from the founding of Saudi Arabia in the beginning of the last century until now has been horizontal, right? We've seen a succession of sons of King Abdulaziz become king, and one dies and the next brother in line takes over, and then he dies and the next brother in line takes over. That has ended now. Now we're seeing a move to a younger generation, and there's no indication that Mohammed bin Salman is going to do what his grandfather did and have 115 sons and allow them to take turns becoming king. We really have no idea what's going to happen in the next generation of Saudi leadership.
Yeah, Jana, go ahead. And also, Jana, if you would, we have about 4 minutes left. I want to talk about the American role here, because as this transition happens in Saudi Arabia, perhaps what the kingdom feels bottom line is that they still have Washington in their back pocket, or vice versa. And there you have the largest empire in the world, the largest economy in the world, the largest military in the world. And as we could see by that 60 Minutes, a ridiculous narrative,
ridiculous. Yes.
That is really the Saudi narrative being presented as some sort of like sort of neutral, benign American news orientation, when in fact it's Saudi propaganda. Anyway, Jana, talk about the U.S. role.
So I think it's been a surprise for the Saudis, because they had expected that the Americans would support them. And I think this is a new thing where Trump wanted to support them more, but the American government didn't actually support their crazy plan, military attack on the region. But it's at the same time, you can read it through Syria and Iraq, because things are changing incredibly now, because probably the war is over and that a new order is coming there, and there's business that's going to happen there. Sorry. With the new infrastructure that's going to be built, with the reconstruction that's going on. So I don't think that the Americans want another war in the region, where it's very sure that if they had attacked Lebanon, the whole region would have come back to a much bigger war.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And a war, a current war, something that would come out of this Lebanon crisis and would be, in a way, a proxy war with the Iranians, would be unlike any of the wars we've seen in the region. Because these other wars have been very clear cut. You know, it was the United States against Saddam Hussein. Then it was the United States against Saddam Hussein again. You know, you have the Saudis and the Kuwaitis on the same side, the rest of the GCC. This would be completely different. It would be very hard to discern exactly what the battle lines are. And what's the end game? Who wins and what does victory look like?
Go ahead. We have 1 minute left, Jana. Go ahead.
Quickly, they also know how strong Hezbollah is, because Hezbollah has defeated Israel before. It's defeated ISIS now in Iraq and Syria. And so they know how strong it is. And they know, everybody I think knows also, that unless you hit it from the inside, meaning unless you have an internal war in Lebanon, Hezbollah is strong. And one thing that has happened in the past 3 weeks is that there's a surprising unity that has grown in Lebanon. None of us actually in Lebanon has imagined that it's going to grow, because of course, people have different opinions about what Hezbollah is doing in Syria. But then the moment when KSA had done this to Hariri, and that Hezbollah showed that it's not going to stand and support a sectarian discourse, everybody actually supported Hezbollah. And everybody talked about the fact that an attack on Hezbollah in Lebanon is an attack on all Lebanese. And this has been very important, and this has been very much something I think very successful by the Lebanese government, where they use this to talk about an actual national an attack on a national matter, which is Hariri, instead of saying that this is only a Sunni thing.
Very interesting. Jana Nicole has been our guest along with Robert Carter. Jana is an independent researcher. She's also a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. Robert Carter is a journalist and political commentator on Middle Eastern politics. John, we're going to stay with this story, the law of unintended consequences. Saudi's trying to break Lebanon apart, but in fact, having perhaps just the opposite impact.
And this is really a story I think that every American ought to be following. It's a very important issue.
We're gonna come back to it. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we'll be back with the other big story and then the big news stories of the day. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
New accusations have hit Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. over communications pertaining to Russia. Are more indictments on the way? Plus, Sputnik has once again been the target of fake news, with the Daily Beast and several other media outlets falsely claiming that we have registered as a foreign agent. And Eric Schmidt, the executive chairman of Google's parent company, Alphabet, announced on Saturday that the company will, quote, engineer its algorithms that will make it harder for readers of the internet, in the internet, to find articles from Sputnik News and RT. Those are the articles that would appear on the Google News Network. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. And we are joined from San Diego, California by Dr. Robert Epstein. He is the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. Welcome, Jim, Dan, and Robert. Dan Kovalik, let's start with you. What do you expect? New indictments? More indictments?
I would think there's a couple more. In fact, I think it's pretty well known that there are. I guess they know from the earlier indictments that there's several sealed indictments in the court that have yet to be opened. Apparently, they were numerically in between the ones that have been opened. So, yes, it looks like they have a few more indictments ready to go.
Yeah, it looks like there were four sealed indictments that were between Manafort and Gates. So we don't yet know who those four are, but there are four.
There you go. Is it going to be lying to a lying indictment again, lying to the prosecutors?
Yeah, you know, that's another thing that we've talked about a lot. There are bound to be a lot of these so-called throwaway charges, throwaway felonies. These are felonies that are charged and then negotiated away. Things like making a false statement or perjury or conspiracy, things that that the government will heap on a defendant and then negotiate them away in exchange for a guilty plea at some later point.
Okay, Dr. Epstein, we're talking also about the Google executive Eric Schmidt has announced that they're deranking Sputnik and RT from their Google News Service rankings. We are, quote, working on detecting and deranking those kind of sites. It's basically RT and Sputnik, Schmidt said during a question and answer session at the Halifax International Security Forum in Canada. Talk about this, because it seems to me to go straight to the issue of censorship, Dr. Epstein, that you and we have talked about in the past.
Yes, I wrote a big article last year for U.S. News and World Report about this issue. It was called The New Censorship, and it was about exactly this type of thing occurring. I think we have to worry when a company like Google makes a decision about, you know, what content we're going to see and not see, what news stories we're going to see and not see. So that if, in fact, they are doing this now with Sputnik and RT content, this is yet another example of something that, in fact, meets this concern that I've expressed dramatically. I don't think... I mean, you're on Sputnik. Obviously, it affects you very directly. But I think we have to think, you know, even beyond that, just imagine that kind of power being exercised without any oversight. That's the problem. There's no oversight.
Right.
We don't know exactly how they're doing the demotions and who they're demoting. And there's no committee out there, no organization, no government agencies, nothing that has any way of monitoring or controlling what they're doing. That's a very serious threat, in my opinion, to human freedom and to democracy.
Brian, one of the things that really troubled me was what Eric Schmidt said after the statement that you quoted. He said, as you told our listeners, we are working on detecting and deranking those kinds of sites. It's basically RT and Sputnik. He went on to say, though, we are well aware of it, and we are trying to engineer the systems to prevent the content being delivered to wide audiences, but we don't want to ban the sites. That's not how we operate. What was even more
it's amazing.
Funny
we don't
in
want
a,
to be accused
sad way.
Of banning sites. We'll just make sure that these are some of the most popular sites on Google. Like if you type a news story about a Russia or Iran or Syria, frequently you get RT and Sputnik. I mean, and it wasn't, and those are popular stories, popular sites. Everybody knows that.
The issue of there being or not being government oversight. In fact, this is coming from government pressure. And what they've been called before committees and they've been grilled on this and kind of demanded to do something about it. So what you're finding here, what you're seeing is a very close corporate government relationship where these companies now, which are media monopoly companies that control social media in a certain monopolistic way, Google and Facebook, and they are working hand in glove with the government to do what the government tells them to do. And it is very dangerous, not because there isn't government oversight, but there's a kind of government oversight which clearly is trying to, you know, tell ostensibly private companies how to operate, because those companies are in fact demonstrating that they're arms of the government.
Well, let's have all three of you jump in on that, because I think both points are valid. Dr. Epstein is making the point, Google is, everybody uses Google because they think it's a benign, neutral site that allows you to find out information. And in fact, it's a privately owned company driven by profit that determines in secret what the algorithm is, so that some people see some things and don't see other things. And it's up to Google and there's no oversight. And yet at the same time, what Google is actually doing by banning these previously popular sites that were high up in their search rankings is bowing to a government-sponsored witch hunt, which I don't think there's any other way to look at it. I think Jim Kavanaugh is also right about that. Oh, let's have all three of you talk about that issue, if you would. Go ahead. Let's start next with Dan Kovalik.
Yes, well, I think it's a very serious issue. As you, I think, touched upon, Google is now a virtual monopoly when it comes to internet searches. I don't know anyone who uses any other search but Google. It's almost like Kleenex. You know, it is the standard for internet searches. So if they change these algorithms, it will have a huge impact on readership and on discourse. And let me just say that, back in August, I was reading reports that Google has already started doing this, that there's about a dozen sites that they have deranked already in their North American sites, like Counterpunch, Global Research, Alternet, Black Agenda Report, and that all those groups, again, these dozen alternative media sources have reported a huge decline in readership, anywhere from like 30 to 60% decline. So they're already doing this. And this is a form of censorship. And in a free society, it can't be allowed because, again, Google is almost a quasi-public entity at this point. And I think everyone should be very concerned about this.
Dr. Epstein, go ahead.
Well, I have a couple of things I can add here. First of all, Google's doing this all the time, not just to a select group of websites that we know about. All of my psychological tests, for example, were demoted by Google in March, dramatically decreasing traffic to these psychological tests, which is more than 20 different tests that people take all the time. So they're doing this all the time. They're doing it without announcing what they're doing, without explaining what they're doing. Regarding the oversight issue, I wouldn't say there's government oversight. I would say there's a kind of coordination there that's very disturbing. But that's not what I mean by responsible oversight. And the last point I just want to make here is that Google not only demotes websites in search rankings, which of course can be devastating, but they actually do block. This is going back to that quote from Schmidt. They actually do block access to websites. They block access to millions of websites every day. I explain exactly how this works and why they do it in my article in U.S. News and World Report. So that you really are in danger if they don't like you for one reason or another, or as they put it, if you violate their terms of service, which are very vague, they can actually block access to your website. And not just through Chrome, which is a Google product, they can block access through using Firefox, Safari, or any major browser. It's unbelievable the power that they have and that they do exercise every day.
Before we go back to Jim Kavanaugh, I want you, Dr. Epstein, to just say a little bit more and briefly, how do they ban sites or what sites are they banning?
Well, they're actually blocking access. They don't release the exact number. All they've said publicly is that they tend to add about 10,000 more websites every day to what they call their quarantine list. It's been estimated that their quarantine list probably has at any point in time several million websites on it. And how do they block it? Well, until I figured this out, no one had ever really known how they do it. But it's pretty damn clever. Not just Chrome, but also Safari and even Firefox. And Firefox acknowledges this publicly, by the way. Before they send you to a website, when you're just typing in the name of a URL, before they do that, they check Google's quarantine list to see whether it's a safe site. If it's not, they won't take you there and will give you some sort of warning. If Google says it's safe, then they will take you there. So every single time you use Safari or Firefox to go somewhere, Google is getting information, more and more data about your search history. It's incredible. And Google has the power, literally, to block websites, which is to say they do every single day, claiming that there's malware there. But it's been well established that they often make mistakes when they target a website as containing malware.
That's true. That happens all the time.
Jim Kavanaugh, I want to go to another subject. The Daily Beast reported this morning that Sputnik had registered as a foreign agent. That's not true. Sputnik was not required to register as a foreign agent. RT has been required to register as a foreign agent. We here at Sputnik, we've called a number of other media outlets who also picked up the Daily Beast story and said it's not true. We haven't been asked to register as a foreign agent, and we haven't registered as a foreign agent. And while they're tweaking some of the language, they're not publishing a correction. Not that I'm aware of, at least. I mean, again, this is fake news, but if anybody were to say this is fake news now under these circumstances, it appears that the only fake news that ever comes from anyone obviously comes from some media outlet that has the word Russia or Russian connected to it. Anyway, Jim Kavanaugh, your comments.
Well, sure. Yes, this is, again, I've seen the story here, and it's kind of amazing that they just say these things and they don't really care. You know, they don't really care that it's inaccurate and false, and they will kind of sort of correct it later on if you push them to do it, but nobody really cares. And the substantive fact is what they're trying to do is force all Russia-related media to register or to be identified as some kind of foreign and malignant source that we shouldn't go to. And it's become just incredible to me to watch this continue. You know, I mean, there are news sites from all around the world in every country, BBC, Radio Free Europe, Al Jazeera, and they're not forced to register as foreign agents. The issue doesn't come up. And the coverage of them would be exact if it did come up, as you say. In this case, they can say anything, they can be inexact and they can be wrong. I wouldn't be surprised if they did ask you to register as a foreign agent. The substantive point is they're trying to blacken your name and deter people from either participating on your shows or deter the organization itself from being able to function effectively in the United States. And it's really an attempt, because it happens to be the case, and it's strange to me to see, that these stations, RT and Sputnik, have become, you know, channels that have been broadcasting interesting left-wing and alternative, but also left-wing information. I mean, you're an old organizer of the anti-war left in the United States. We can't see you on mainstream media. You can't see Noam Chomsky on mainstream media. And so these have become alternative sites that have presented things that are important for people to see, and they want to block it. And they want to defame it and say, oh, you know, if we haven't yet gotten around to asking you to be a registered agent, we might as well say that you are anyway, because that's really what we want to do.
That's an important point. It does silence those voices on the left, on the political left here in the United States. And, you know, to make this any more brazenly political, other organizations have not been asked to register or forced to register. BBC, French television, Al Jazeera, even AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, doesn't have to register as a representative of a foreign government. So this is very specific to RT and by extension to Sputnik, and it's to silence alternative voices. There's no other explanation for it.
Yeah, and Sputnik and RT are a mix. Like, there is the left. They're like our show, like my show. Mm-hmm. When, you know, everybody knows I'm a longtime anti-war organizer from the left, but they also have libertarian voices.
Sure.
They also have voices. It's a variety. It's not just one thing. I mean, that's actually what makes RT and Sputnik so interesting for so many different kinds of audiences, is that there really is truly a variety of voices, unlike the corporate-owned mainstream media. And just to go back to Jim's point, before the Iraq War, when we were organizing demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people against the Iraq War before it started, month after month after month, I was a regular on MSNBC and Fox and CNN, and that abruptly came to a halt, where a few of our voices, it wasn't just mine, we were suddenly off those networks, completely vanquished. And then those spaces were filled up with retired colonels and generals.
Sure.
And admirals and people talking about what the new tactic of the war would be, rather than whether there should be a war. In other words, the whole debate got redefined. And then you have alternative media sources that become platforms for voices that are critical in one way or another of some part of U.S. policy, domestic or foreign. And now those are labeled as we were labeled before the Iraq War, as agents or apologists for Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. because we said we were against a war against Saddam Hussein.
And then it is those sites that are in turn blocked by the likes of Google.
Dr. Epstein, let's go to you. I'm reading now again here, giving insight on the capabilities of the new algorithm. The Google official said that it would indicate that it would be able to detect, quote, repetitive, exploitative, faults, and weaponized information. I mean, what is that? These are just, what are those words? Repetitive, exploitative, faults, and weaponized information. What's that?
Well, I published a couple of months ago in Fast Company an analysis of one of the big algorithms that Google is using to make these kinds of decisions. And I showed in that article that this particular algorithm is literally an idiot. I mean, it makes so many mistakes that we shouldn't possibly trust the algorithms that they're developing to make these kinds of critically important decisions, again, about what to censor and what not to censor. So the algorithms that they are using are extremely primitive. Artificial intelligence at this point, no matter what the hype is that you've seen, is extremely primitive. And I'm very fearful, not just that these people are making these determinations, but that they're using exquisitely stupid algorithms to make these determinations.
Dan Kovalik, where does it all end? I mean, it seems to me that unless people stand up, and fight back and say, look, it's not acceptable that private corporations under pressure from government entities or different bodies of the government are going to determine what we can read, where we can read it, how frequently we can see it. Unless people stand up, this thing has its own logic. I mean, it doesn't just end by itself. And in fact, it grows by itself. Because then if you have people who get intimidated, they say, well, I don't want to be associated with this or that network, even though I might have in the past. I mean, we have people who would be proud to be on RT or Sputnik in the past who are now saying, oh, I don't know if I can do RT or Sputnik. I mean, really? I mean, if people who say they care about things, who have principles, are so intimidated or so afraid, then the witch hunt wins.
Look what happened with John Kiriakou. I can't believe that. On October 9th, I read that story where the people for Bernie Sanders said we wouldn't go on the stage with him.
That's right.
Talk about that, John Kiriakou. Not everybody knows the details.
No, that's right. I was invited to speak at the European Union. I was invited to appear on two panels. The morning panel was on corporate influence in American politics. And another panel member was supposed to be a representative of People for Bernie, one of the organizations associated with the Sanders campaign. And that representative refused to appear on the panel with me because I work for Sputnik. And she said that she didn't want to appear to be endorsing Russian propaganda. And so rather than her just not participating in the panel, I was thrown off the panel. And the panel went forward without me.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, so, and of course, I mean, let's just give the example that you gave, Brian, about the Iraq War in 2003. The so-called propagandists, the anti-war movement, Russia itself, Putin himself, RT, were right. We were demonstrably right. There were no weapons of mass destruction. We were saying that. There were a few people saying that, but not enough people. We went to war based on a lie. And the lies were being told by the so-called mainstream media, the New York Times, most notably, but everyone else, too, and NPR. You know, there needs to be this alternative voice, this alternative narrative out there on the important issues of the day, like war and peace. And this attempt to censor RT, Sputnik, and again, a number of other alternative media sources is really an attempt to censor the truth. And that is just a fact. And people should be very worried about that.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, back in 2003, when we were pushed off of MSNBC and pushed off of Fox and CNN, there weren't these alternative. RT actually didn't yet exist in 2003. And so as a consequence, as the country was being taken to war based on a lie, and it wasn't a mistake, it was a lie. The U.S. government knew Iraq was not a threat to anybody. They knew Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction.
Correct.
They knew it was hobbled. They knew it was surrounded. They knew it was inspected over and over again. It was a lie, but there wasn't significant alternative media. We created as much as we could by grassroots opposition. We tried to stop a war that took 1 million Iraqi lives, 5,000 American lives, tens of thousands of American soldiers who have life-changing injuries of a physical or psychological character. We tried to stop that. And the U.S. mainstream media, which at that time shut us out, well, we didn't have an alternative media. Well, we had maybe some, Pacifica, but nothing like RT or Sputnik, which has a bigger reach.
Yeah, nothing like the internet sources that we have now. What they're trying to do now is, at that point, as you say, they could get you off of MSNBC, they could fire Phil Donahue, they could make sure nobody got on. And there weren't many other sources that were easily accessible. Now people do have accessibility to these sources, and it's caused problems. It's caused problems from the right and from the left, alt-right, and you've got leftist movement. You've got people reading things and hearing stories about what were, Washington consensus positions that are being questioned in all kinds of ways, that are, some of them are crazy, but some of them are importantly critical and correct. And what they're trying to do now is stop that and get back to a position, it's going to be very hard for them to do, where it's hard for people to get at alternative sources of information and analysis. And it's very important for them to do that. And, you know, unfortunately, fortunately for them, they have enough power now, the organizations on the that control the internet, the quote-unquote private organizations, have kind of monopolized enough so that they can use a few strong private organizations like Google and Facebook that have become the channel into the internet and the funnel into the internet, and they can create choke points there that are, that can be more effective in shutting things off.
We have about 2 minutes left. I want to ask both Dr. Epstein and Dan to do a minute each. Dr. Epstein, you've done so much important research in this area about the significance of these media technology outlets. A lot of people rely on Facebook to get their news. A lot of people use Google over and over again. What can people do? What should people do right now? 1 minute, and then I'll throw it to Dan for the last minute.
Sure. Well, let me point out, first of all, that Vladimir Putin does not put words in my mouth. You don't put words in my mouth. I'm a researcher. I publish in outstanding scientific journals. I also not only publish on Sputnik, I also publish, in completely different kinds of, I publish in Politico. I publish in Time Magazine and so on. So as far as I'm concerned, you guys are just being responsible, in featuring some of the research that I do on your airwaves. What people can do, it's really honestly quite limited. But I think we all have to push together, moving in the direction of regulating Google and Facebook and possibly some of these other online companies that have much too much power. We have to begin to let our representatives in Congress know it's gotten out of hand, that we're deeply concerned. We have to move in the direction of legislation and regulation.
Okay. And Dan Kovalik, you get the last word, about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I totally agree. I mean, we have to fight for net neutrality, and we have to stand up for people's right to speak and to be heard. There's the adage, I may disagree with someone, but I'll fight for their right to be able to say it. And we need to take that stand.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. That was Dan Kovalik, human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. We've also been joined by Jim Kavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. And from San Diego, by Dr. Robert Epstein, senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. After a very short break, we'll be back with the big stories of the day. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.